Between wind and waves on the coast and abundant sunshine everywhere else, it stands to reason that our region would have a few advantages in the development of clean energy resources, the kind that generally do not involve setting things on fire or otherwise releasing greenhouse gases. A couple of organizations on California's north coast are making moves on clean energy. We'll check in with them today. Matthew Marshall is the executive director at the Redwood Coast Energy Authority. He'll be a speaker at an environmental law conference in Eureka tomorrow. Welcome, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. Jim Zolik is our guest as well. He's senior research engineer at the Schatz Energy Research Center at Humboldt State University. Jim, welcome to you.
Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. Matt, let's start with you. Tell us a bit about what the RCEA, Redwood Coast Energy Authority, does.
Yeah, we're a local government joint powers agency. So we are a shared government agency between the county of Humboldt, the seven incorporated cities within the county, and the Humboldt Bay Water District. And we were formed back in 2003 with the purpose of moving sustainable energy initiatives forward in the county and on the North Coast. A lot of that's really been focused on energy efficiency, which has kind of been the sort of, you know, the really bread and butter activity over the years of, you know, working with businesses and homeowners to help make energy efficiency improvements. And that's kind of the low-hanging fruit in the energy sector as far as, you know, cost effectiveness. But, you know, these days we're doing a lot more also around transportation as well as renewable energy and working quite a bit with the folks at Humboldt State.
So, Matt, how does the average person interface with RCEA, or do they directly?
Yeah, you know, we work with actually, you know, hundreds of homeowners and businesses a year in Humboldt County. And, you know, they can go to our website, which is redwoodenergy.org, or they can, you know, call up, you know, our number's on there, or it's 707-269-1700, you know, and really we actually do a lot of, like, in-home visits with, you know, at no cost to homeowners. We can come out and help do assessments of, you know, your home if you're a PG&E customer here in Humboldt County. And we provide, you know, some incentives for upgrade projects, you know, same services for businesses, either incentives. Sometimes we can even do, you know, minor upgrades like changing out lights for, you know, LED bulbs, and we can do that at no cost. And so we've got a range of different services and incentive programs that people can just call up or stop by our office in Eureka and learn about how, you know, and come out to their home or their business and help them out.
You got that number well memorized, I see. 707-269-1700, was
that,
it?
That is what it is, yes. I say it often, so.
I bet you do. Are there similar agencies to RCEA across California?
You know, we're somewhat unique in the fact that, you know, we were formed as a joint powers agency exclusively to work on energy issues. And, you know, I think that had a lot to do with the sort of economies of scale in a small, you know, rural county, small in population, that is. There was kind of the challenge of, you know, how do we kind of, you know, move things forward as local governments on the energy sector. You know, if you're in San Francisco, they've got environmental departments and, you know, and staff that work on these issues. And so we're fairly unique in that sense. That said, you know, there's certainly a lot of similar government programs and, you know, partnerships. We work a lot in partnership with PG&E, and there's similar partnerships across PG&E service territory. So I would say there's very similar, you know, work going on, although our entity is a little bit more unique.
That's Matt Marshall at the Redwood Coast Energy Authority. We also have Jim Zolik, senior research engineer at the Schatz Energy Research Center at Humboldt State University. Jim, tell us about the work that, and first of all, am I pronouncing it Schatz correctly?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So tell us about the work that goes on at the lab.
Sure. The lab has been around for about 25 years now, and our mission is to promote the use of clean and renewable energy. We're affiliated with Humboldt State University and in particular, the Environmental Resources Engineering Program at Humboldt State. And our work in terms of geographic kind of coverage ranges from local work. We've been doing quite a bit of work locally over the last decade or so, especially a real strong partnership with the Redwood Coast Energy Authority, and I think we'll talk more about that work today. We also do work statewide, nationally, and even there's a large portion of our work now that actually is international. And we're a relatively small group. I think roughly 30 people total, about 20 of those kind of more full-time, and then 10 sort of part-time student researchers, et cetera. And it ranges from things like you know, benchtop and field research with sort of technology development and testing, to planning work, analysis, consulting, evaluation type work. And then actually to project implementation of real-world energy projects, both here on the North Coast, but in these other regions we work as well.
Let me invite our listeners again to join our discussion about clean energy, particularly the efforts going on the North Coast in California. Jim Zolik, you just heard, is the senior research engineer at the Schatz Energy Research Center at Humboldt State University. Matthew Marshall's on the line as well. He's the executive director at the Redwood Coast Energy Authority. Questions and comments, welcome. 800-838-3760 by phone across the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Jim Zolik, are there some things about the North Coast that make it a particularly good place to explore clean energy?
There are. And, you know, I guess one of the things, there's a number of things that make it a good place. There are also some things that make it a very important place. And so I'll start there, maybe. First of all, we're sort of an energy island, not exactly an island, maybe more of a peninsula is probably more correct. But we're pretty isolated here on the North Coast. With regard to the electric system, the infrastructure, there are two major electrical transmission lines that come over from the I-5 corridor, which is kind of the main backbone that comes all the way from the Pacific Northwest all the way down through California. So there's two connections there, and those are can be at risk at times, and they're actually not large enough to supply all the energy we need here. So we have to generate a good portion of our electricity locally, and we've done that for. For decades.
It's interesting to think that that parallel, though, because I mean, it's hard to get to Eureka, that area by road, for example, because it's a little isolated. But I'd never thought about power transmission lines.
And the same holds true for natural gas. So we do have natural gas here on the North Coast, but there's a single natural gas line that's like a 12-inch diameter line. If something happens to that line, we're without natural gas. And then our transportation fuels. Gasoline and diesel are primarily barged in through Humboldt Bay, and if you've ever been around Humboldt Bay area, the very narrow mouth to the bay, pretty tricky entrance. When there's storms and things, that can be real tricky. So, and then some is trucked in. So, our connection with the rest of the world in terms of getting energy in and out of the county is a bit tricky. So that's a real motivator to develop local energy. As well as the environmental benefits, the economic benefits of keeping that money in the county and in the area and creating jobs. And then what we found with the research we've been doing is that we have a tremendous renewable energy resource base here. A lot of biomass energy, a lot of wind, a lot of wave, small hydro is pretty substantial around here, solar. And then things like energy efficiency are important everywhere, and RCA has a big role in that, as well as the other areas. so those are some things that kind of make it a. And we sort of look at, because we're kind of a small isolated area, we kind of look at ourselves as, in a way, as a test bed of exploring what can be done in a community. And then, hopefully looking to how that potentially could be expanded beyond just the North Coast.
When we get to the discussions of energy efficiency, and this is a question for each of you in turn, I mean, and I'll start with you, Matt, because you used the term low-hanging fruit first. Have we plucked most of the low-hanging fruit? I mean, at this point, are we having to work a bit harder to get further reductions in energy use?
That's true. I think there's been some easy technologies to implement, such as like compact fluorescence and, like linear high efficiency fluorescent tubes and, in the commercial sector particularly, that, are fairly easy measures to deploy and, pretty cost effective. Those things have a really quick payback. And so it's, close to a no-brainer to say, hey, if you've got a business and you've got linear fluorescence or, incandescent lighting, you can make that switch. I think where there's actually a little bit of a second wave is really with LED technology. And, there was a lot of applications where compact fluorescence really didn't quite cut it. And then even, and so with LEDs coming on, that's really been, opening up that market. And there's actually savings potential going from even a compact fluorescent to an LED. So as sort of the compact fluorescents are wearing out, there's kind of a second opportunity there to upgrade again. And even now with linear fluorescent tubes, that you see in commercial buildings typically, there's the potential to install LED retrofits to those fixtures, which actually is kind of another cutting of the energy use in half again. And so we're actually kind of with LED technology really hitting the mainstream. There's kind of a second wave, I would say, of low-hanging fruit. And, and I bring that up because lighting is really, it's a big part of, certainly commercial and also, potentially residential energy use. And it's, the easiest thing to retrofit. It's changing a light bulb or, changing a fixture, which is pretty simple. It's a lot easier than insulating an attic or doing a major, water heater or furnace retrofit. I think, on the one hand, we're getting sort of a little bit of a reprieve with LEDs kind of providing a second opportunity to say, hey, here's easy things you can do to make a significant impact. That said, I think really kind of going beyond that and saying, hey, we got to get to not just the low-hanging fruit and the easy stuff. How do we kind of move forward on these larger projects and figuring out, financing programs or technical assistance programs that help customers kind of take that, larger plunge and chip off at bigger projects as well.
It always seems like there is another level of technology that assists the process, that for example, takes us from compact fluorescence to LEDs. Now, it seems like one of the major obstacles in further developments in not just energy production, but in storage, because you get irregularities of things like wind and waves, is batteries. Jim Zolik, how much work do you do at the Schatz Energy Research Center on battery technology?
We do actually a fair amount, though most of the work that we've been doing with battery technology is on batteries on a small scale, because we do a lot of work, I mentioned earlier, internationally and in particular in the developing world in Africa and Asia, with a program called it's called Lighting Africa, Lighting Global, and it's aimed at getting off-grid lighting, and it's basically the technology that Matthew was just talking about, LED lighting. So not only is it, a new high technology here in the developed world, but it's also being implemented in the developing world in very small lighting products that people can use in place of oil-based, kerosene-based lighting, which is very, very bad health hazard. It's a danger in terms of fires and things, and it also actually emits a lot of black carbon, which is a really sort of nasty greenhouse gas warming, culprit. So that's the batteries that we do most of our work with at the lab at this point are on that small scale. But we are involved with electric vehicles and fuel cell vehicles and the batteries in those devices as well. And batteries, certainly are continuing to evolve, get more efficient, get cheaper. Certainly, with electric vehicles now, lithium-ion batteries, both in our large-scale electric vehicles, but in our small handheld appliances, laptop computers, that kind of thing, really do keep advancing. And I think that's, the question about low-hanging fruit, whether it be energy efficiency or on the generation side, that's the one thing that does, luckily kind of keep us moving forward, because we do go after the low-hanging fruit first. That's what makes the most sense. And as we tend to, grab that and collect what's there, luckily there's new low-hanging fruit that does come along because there's new technologies that are developed. And then, here in the state of California, the policy level, the state really continues to push policy. So, we've gone, the building code here has been probably the most ambitious in the country for a long time. And it's what's kept California's electricity use relatively flat, where the rest of the country has been on a steady incline. So that's a real plus. And the state is now even pushing for, in new buildings, we're headed toward what they call zero net energy. So the building is supposed to be designed to be super efficient, but also include on-site generation, so that the net the sort of net energy footprint for that facility comes out to zero on a, on an annual basis.
So it produces as much energy as it consumes.
Basically, yes. And that's actually, that will eventually, I think, where we're headed, that eventually will be part of the building code in California. When you build a new building, it will be required to essentially make as much energy as it uses.
Let me invite our listeners once again to join us as we're talking about renewable energy and clean energy here on the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Zolik, Senior Research Engineer at the Schatz Energy Research Center at Humboldt State University. We're joined by Matthew Marshall, who's the Executive Director at the Redwood Coast Energy Authority. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Matt, I noticed something called the Repower Humboldt Plan. Tell us a bit about that, would you?
Yeah, and that was something we produced with the Schatz Energy Research Center, as well as many other partners, including PG&E. And it was really getting at what Jim was talking about earlier, as far as, you know, what are our local resources and what's sort of a strategic plan to meet our local energy needs with local resources here in Humboldt County. And, you know, the big outcome is, you know, of that was that it's actually possible, and, you know, and it's viable with sort of a mix, you know, portfolio of different resources. You know, there's no silver bullet of, oh, if we just do enough solar or we just do enough wind, that, you know, it's really kind of having a range of resources available. And then, you know, right now we're actually kind of at the point of we're looking at, you know, one of the ways to move that forward is establishing a community choice aggregation program, which is a not very appealing name for sort of an exciting possibility, that it's basically where a local government or a group of local governments through like a joint powers agency such as ourselves can take on the generation component of providing electricity service. So the existing utility still maintains the transmission lines and distribution and still are the ones that, you know, are owning and operating that infrastructure to get the power from the generation source to the customer. And they still take care of, you know, the billing and the customer service. But the generation component on your bill, which is about half of the bill, give or take, that becomes sort of the purview of the local government entity. The choice part of the community choice name comes from the fact that customers can choose to opt out of the program. So if for whatever reason they want to stick with the existing utility service for the generation, they can do that and just say, oh, you know, I'm happy with the mix I've got and the price I've got. But it's a exciting opportunity for more local control of where that electricity is being generated. There's a potential for rate savings. You know, most of the CCA programs have had, you know, minor to significant rate savings depending on what priorities the community set of whether they wanted to push the boundary on renewables or if they wanted to maximize rate savings. There's only two that have really gotten up and running in California so far, in Marin and Sonoma counties, but there's over 1,000 community choice programs across the country in other states, and so it's not a new thing nationally. But it is something that's fairly new to get off the ground here in California. But following in the footsteps of Marin and Sonoma, you know, we're looking at hopefully rolling out a program potentially next year. And then there's quite a few other local governments across the state that are now picking up interest and exploring the option.
So instead of household by household saying, I want, you know, this much power to come from green energy resources, that sort of thing, it's the whole community saying it?
Yeah, so, you know, the community would say, hey, let's, you know, and it's through a local process with the local elected officials, you know, kind of being the governing body. And so the local community kind of sets what, you know, the priorities are, and you can pursue, you know, local generation, you know, increasing the percentage of renewable resources. And then, you know, like I said, each individual customer, so even if the, you know, the city of Eureka opts into the program, any business or any homeowner within Eureka, for whatever reason, can say, you know, I'd rather stick with PG&E for my generation services, and they have the right to do that. So it really does provide a choice where right now, you know, customers don't really have a choice of where their utility, you know, electricity generation is coming from. And both Marin and Sonoma have been able to have a higher percentage of renewable energy than PG&E while also having lower rates. So, you know, you don't always get to have your cake and eat it too, but in this case, it actually is possible to achieve both those goals.
Jim Zolik at the Schatz Lab, you mentioned some of the regional advantages for working on clean energy resources in the Humboldt Bay Area. One of them is biomass, but the question that always comes up when we talk about burning woody waste is you're still setting something on fire, so aren't there emissions issues there?
Well, yes, there are still emissions issues with biomass, and though it can be, you know, there again, technology advances, it can be done quite cleanly. You can really minimize the particulates, and now there's always going to be carbon dioxide released. Certainly, it would, you know, it's possible for CO2 capture, but that's something that's you know, still at this point pretty expensive and really more kind of in the, you know, experimental and demonstration early demonstration stages. But, you know, for instance, in Humboldt County, what we have three biomass power plants, only one actually at the moment, which is operating, two that are now idle, but they've all been operating in the recent past. And those were originally built here because there was so much wood waste from the mills, and this is, you know, in the past there was a lot of mills. There's not as many anymore. Right. And they were generating so much waste, and they had to do something with it. So they, you know, this is going way back to the, you know, probably the 60s and early 70s. They had teepee burners, you know, where they burned that wood waste, and that those things were, producing a really, really nasty air quality problem. So that was really, you know, part of the impetus for them to build those power plants was that they had this waste problem and this air quality problem, and they realized, hey, if we burn it in a power plant much more controlled, we can actually clean up the air. We can get a valuable resource, electrical power and steam and heat for process needs out of that, and really come out better. So the biomass, you know, and biomass is a tricky one because it depends on the details. Where does the biomass come from? How is it accessed? What was going to happen to it anyway? You know, if you're going out into the forest and cutting virgin trees just to run a power plant, probably not a good idea. But if there's operations, we're using wood for you know, building houses and things anyway. If there's a lot of waste from that, if you can utilize that, which would have been, you know, would have, the CO2 would have gone into the atmosphere anyway, would have been wasted anyway. Or there's a lot of, you know, with all the forest fires we're having now, there's a lot of desire and efforts to want to reduce the fuel loading in the forest. And there again, that's a waste product that potentially can be utilized. Part of the challenge is that if the material is still in the woods, whether it's timber slash or fuel reduction material, it's pretty expensive to transport it to a place where you can utilize it, and also just kind of process it into a form that's, you know, that's usable. And that's some of the work that's going on now at the Schatz Lab. There's a project called Waste to Wisdom, which is funded by the U.S. Department of Energy and USDA. And actually the Schatz Lab is partnered with the Forestry Department at Humboldt State right now, looking into how can we utilize these materials, how can we cost-effectively get them out of the woods. And a lot of the focus is on can we process them close to the source and basically densify them and really increase their value so that you then can transport them far enough and to be able to utilize them.
We got about 30 seconds left, and one email from Bruce in Ashland. He asks, how many years does it take for a panel, I assume a solar panel, to produce more energy than it took to make it? Either one of you know the answer to that?
It's pretty short, actually. I think the numbers I've seen, and it's probably better now because this was quite some time ago, but it was like 4 to 7 years in that range. So
definitely outlast the time in which it took to restore the investment in energy.
Yeah, they last at least 20 years or longer. So.
All right, Jim Zolik, Senior Research Engineer at the Schatz Energy Research Center at Humboldt State University. Matthew Marshall, Executive Director at the Redwood Coast Energy Authority. Thank you both for joining us today to talk clean energy.
Thanks,
Jeff.